Joining us from Rafah is UNICEF spokesperson Tess Ingram. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us. So there's been a report that this week a UNICEF vehicle waiting to enter northern Gaza was hit by, quote, live ammunition. Can you tell us a little more about what happened there?
Yeah, of course. I was in that car that was hit. It was waiting at a holding point just south of the Wadi Gaza checkpoint, where we are often instructed to wait before being called through the checkpoint. We were waiting there as instructed, and gunfire broke out in the vicinity. It seemed to be coming from the direction of the checkpoint towards civilians, who then turned and fled from the checkpoint. Luckily, myself and my colleagues, we were all safe, but this just underscores how dangerous it is for humanitarian aid workers in Gaza at the moment that incidents like this continue to happen when they absolutely shouldn't.
Right. And was this shooting? Was this, artillery? What was it exactly that hit the vehicle?
It appeared to be small arms fire, so gunfire.
Gunfire. Okay. And were you then able to proceed and continue to northern Gaza, or were you also turned back?
So we were hoping to proceed. We decided to go ahead because it was such a critical mission with nutrition products for the children who are malnourished in the north of Gaza, among other things. Unfortunately, after deciding that we would go ahead, we were still delayed. We waited at that holding point for at least another 2 hours before deciding that the mission was no longer feasible because we didn't have enough time, even if we were given the green light to go up, conduct all of our activities and then get back. So we had to turn around and come back to Rafah, but we hope to reschedule it for the coming days.
Okay. And I'm really sorry to hear what happened to you and your colleagues. Is everybody okay? I mean, we're glad you're okay. Is everybody else in the car okay?
Yes, all of the colleagues are okay, thankfully, but this is, something that happens almost every day in Gaza, not always to us, but to the children as well. And I've seen so many examples here of children who've been wounded in this war, and it's just heartbreaking.
Speaking of the children, and especially in northern Gaza, the UN system has been warning of an imminent famine, particularly in that area. You've met with a lot of the children in Gaza in general. Can you just tell us, can you tell us what, about their situation, the children who face these conditions?
Yeah, it's tragic to see anybody suffering from malnutrition, which is such a painful condition, let alone in a place where malnutrition was almost non-existent before October. And it's now skyrocketed in the north of Gaza because of disruptions to food production, but also because of restrictions on aid access to that area. We've really struggled to get up there with aid. And as a result, we know that children are dying of malnutrition there. At least 23 children have reportedly died at the Kamal Adwan Hospital, which is where we were trying to bring these nutrition treatments on Tuesday.
Is there a particular story that you heard? Did this particular child that struck you that really resonated with you?
In regards to malnutrition?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a boy that I met in the middle area at Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir Bala. His name's Omar, he's 7 years old, and I wasn't able to speak to him because he was in such a terrible condition, so much pain. But I talked to his grandmother, and she was telling me that they had just come down from the north 48 hours earlier, and that in the north they had access to barely any food, and they were relying heavily on grass to sustain them. And you could see how sick Omar is. I really hope that he's okay now. The director of pediatrics at the hospital told me that he hoped that Omar would make a full recovery. But concerningly, he said that 90% of the children that they're admitting at the moment have some level of malnutrition, which is just shocking.
And Israel said that it has the intention at least to open the Erez crossing into northern Gaza. Has this materialized yet? Were you able to get anything in to relieve the situation?
No, not yet. And that is such a critical step. We really need that crossing to be open. So, one, that we can increase the volume of aid as a whole, but two, so that we have direct access straight into the north. And that's important for two reasons. One, it'll allow us bring aid in FASTA, and at scale to these children and families in the north who desperately need food and nutrition supplies. But also it will prevent us as the UN having to drive through the whole Gaza Strip with our aid, which is important in such a dangerous place.
You've seen, you know, these children, you've seen the conditions there, and you said that people are relying on grass for food in northern Gaza. Is there still time to avoid the famine that the UN has been warning about, or are we already too late?
Look, it's really hard to know. We've said that a famine could happen at any moment between now and May, and I think that still holds in the north of Gaza. For the south, the risk of famine is there, but I think we can still prevent it if we can just flood the Gaza Strip with aid. There is still time to prevent a famine in the middle and south of Gaza.
And, you know, we've been hearing many calls on the international stage for increased humanitarian access, increased humanitarian aid, flood Gaza with aid. But this has been to no avail. What needs to happen to make that happen?
Well, the best way to make that happen is a ceasefire. It is the only way to end the killing and injuring of children. It is the best way to ensure that we can bring in more aid and to distribute that aid at scale safely to all of the children and families in Gaza in need.
Can you tell us, you said you visited hospitals in Gaza, and we know that the healthcare system in the Strip is on the verge of collapse. Can you tell us what that means in practical terms, in real life terms?
In real life terms, what that means is doctors are struggling to provide the care that they want to and that they're used to in Gaza. It means that supplies are running out. It means that staff are unable to be paid salaries, and many more of them are having to become volunteers. And that's not sustainable because they have to be able to support their families in such desperate conditions. It means that children are dying without the appropriate medical care, or they're unable to receive treatment that they need. For example, I met a girl at the European hospital this week. Her name's Juri, and she's 9 years old. She is from Rafah here at the south of the Gaza Strip. And despite this being an area where there hasn't been a ground offensive yet, she was in a building, her grandparents' house, that was struck. And Juri said the last thing she remembers is playing with birds in a cage at the house, and then waking up in European hospital. And she has so many broken bones, the right side of her face and her arm and her wrist. But on the left side of her body, where she was struck by the impact of the blast, she has enormous open wounds that haven't been able to be treated in Gaza. When I met her, it had been 16 days since the incident, and she was still lying in a hospital bed with very painful, large open wounds, waiting, hoping that she might be able to be medevaced away from Gaza to get the treatment that she needs. But this has to be unacceptable to the world, that a 9-year-old girl who was just visiting her grandparents ends up with such a traumatic injury that cannot be treated, and she's still waiting for help.
You spoke about that Rafah currently doesn't have a ground offensive, and there are growing fears, of course, that this incursion is going to happen after the government announced that it actually has a date for that operation. How is UNICEF preparing itself to deal with that?
We're preparing contingency plans. We're trying to strategize about how we'll continue to do our job. We don't intend to go anywhere. We're going to stay and deliver and make sure that we can continue to provide support to the children and families of Gaza. But there's no doubt that it will be incredibly difficult to do that if there is a ground offensive in Rafah, not to mention what a catastrophe that would be for the families there that have already endured so much.
I wanted to speak, just touch a little on education. UN spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric said the other day that 100% of children in Gaza are out of school. Do you think we lost a generation in Gaza?
Look, I think, you know, 625,000 students haven't had access to education since October. And when I meet kids here, one of the first things they tell me is how much they miss school, miss learning, miss their friends, what their favorite subject used to be. These children want to learn. They want to go back to school. But the longer it goes, the harder it becomes. So we really need to make sure that these children can go back to school as soon as possible, informal learning, but in the meantime, have some sort of temporary learning. And that's what we're trying to set up at the moment as UNICEF.
Of course, with the attention on the immediate catastrophe at hand, longer term effects can sometimes be overlooked. What are some of those long-term effects that UNICEF is expecting on children in Gaza? And is there anything being done now to address them once the guns fall silent?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I think it's something that's often overlooked is the mental health impact of this war. And we know that children are experiencing repeated trauma, which will certainly have long-term impacts. If you think about other conflicts around the world, a child may experience one or two incidences of trauma, but generally then they're able to flee to safety. But in Gaza, children are trapped and they're not able to leave, and every day they're experiencing some form of trauma, whether that's an explosion, losing a family member, not knowing whether somebody is okay. Living with that fear day in, day out definitely impacts them, and it can have developmental impacts on their bodies as well. So this is something that we're very concerned about, and we're working now to try and mitigate it in the small ways that we can. We can't yet provide counseling because children aren't safe. And until children are safe and are able to stop and reflect and feel protected, it's very difficult to treat mental health. But what we're doing at the moment is providing recreational activities and psychosocial support in groups so that children can come together and teenagers and play or do some arts and crafts or some drama, or simply counsel each other if they're a bit older. And just for a moment, have a sense of community or a sense of childhood. And I've seen it, and it's a really nice thing to witness these children laughing and smiling amid the horror around us.
You know, so many people want to do something about this situation, regular people, and they feel helpless. They feel like their hands are tied. What can they do to support Gazans?
I think the most important thing that we need to do is to continue advocating for a ceasefire through whatever channels you're able to continue to call for an end to the fighting, because that really is the only way that we're going to be able to end this situation and end the fear and the death and the destruction for the children of Gaza. But until that happens, the other thing that's really important is support for the humanitarian agencies on the ground, like UNICEF, like UNRWA, like WHO and WFP. We're all here doing our best to try and help the people of Gaza, and we need the international community's support to continue that work.
And finally, I wanted to ask, of course, this was a very somber Eid for Muslims around the world who are closely following the events in Gaza. Is there a message of hope that you can give them for those who feel like all hope is lost?
I think I see small shards of hope here every day, and I see it in the people of Gaza and in the sense of community. I think they're looking after one another in a really remarkable way, considering the terrible circumstances, that people really do care and extend help to others. And that brings me hope. That brings me hope that the fabric of the society is remaining strong, and that the people of Gaza can hopefully rebuild once all of this ends.